Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments yesterday for and against the medical use of marijuana. The federal government says it's against the law. Patients say they need it. Nearly a dozen states have said okay. Tonight on Point, the debate over medical marijuana and America's tortured relationship with pot. But first tonight, a new scientific report links stress and aging. That link has been conventional wisdom for a long time, but until now the exact stress connection between psychology and biology was undefined. A new study published today in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences links high stress and the physical deterioration of human cells. Rob Stein is national science reporter for The Washington Post. I asked him why scientists are so excited about the new finding.
The reason they're so excited about this new finding is that it represents the first real direct link between psychological stress and the aging process. This is something that people have suspected for quite some time, and there's been some evidence that being under emotional strain increases the risk for getting sick, but there really hasn't been a direct link, at least on a cellular level, for how this might actually happen.
So when someone says, "You're giving me gray hairs," it may be true.
In a sense, yes. This suggests that that may very well be true, that our emotions, at least intense, stressful emotions over long periods of time, could have a direct effect on our body's physical functions in a way that causes it to deteriorate more quickly.
And give us a sense of how emotions interact with physical cells.
What this study suggests may be going on is that when someone is under intense emotional stress for long periods of time, it causes certain structures inside their cells called telomeres to shrink. Now, telomeres are the ends of chromosomes which carry all of our genes. They're sort of like the plastic tips on shoelaces that keep the ends from fraying.
Right.
And in the normal aging process, these structures get shorter and shorter as time goes by, and that plays an important role in how we age normally. What they found in this study is that women who had been under intense stress for long periods of time had shorter telomeres than other women. And the more stress they're under, the longer periods of time, the shorter their telomeres. So that suggests that that might be the process by which emotional stress takes its toll.
And when those are reduced, that's tantamount to aging?
It at least plays an important role or contributes to the aging process, because after a while, when the telomeres get so short, cells can no longer divide, and it begins to have an effect on the tissues. If your cells in your immune system, for example, lose their ability to divide, your immune system might get weaker, making you more prone to diseases.
What kinds of stress are we talking about here? Maybe you should describe, for starters, the study itself. What kinds of stress were the participants under?
Yeah, that's an important point, because this isn't your sort of routine day-to-day, I'm late for work, I missed the bus kind of stress. This study involved women who had been caring for chronically ill children for many years, and these were children with very serious health problems like cerebral palsy or autism, which requires round-the-clock kind of care. And so they had been under very intense emotional stress for many years. What they did is they studied 39 of these women, and they compared them to 19 other women who were pretty much exactly the same, except they had healthy children. And they essentially took samples of their blood, and they looked at their white blood cells to examine the telomeres inside their white blood cells. And when they compared the women who had been caring for the sick children to the women who had not been, they found a big difference in the length of their telomeres. The women who had been caring for the children, their telomeres were significantly shorter. And they also had lower levels of an enzyme called telomerase, which takes care of telomeres and keeps them from deteriorating as quickly as they might otherwise.
What kind of physical problems, then, or ailments might that deterioration lead to?
Well, they didn't measure that precisely. precisely in this study, but the implication is that if these women are experiencing an abnormal or faster shortening of their telomeres than they might normally experience, then they would be prone to more health problems sooner and might experience just all of the range of physical signs of aging that you see in people as they normally get age. In fact, one of the key findings was that emotional stress was important, but what was probably more important than the actual stress was a woman's perception of the amount of stress she was under. The women who had the highest levels of perceived stress had the shortest telomeres. So that says that the way people experience their stress is an important component of how quickly they might age.
If this is confirmed in further studies, what kind of action path does it suggest for the medical profession, for the field of psychology, for stressed out Americans just dealing with life?
Yeah, the first sort of take-home message from this is that, you know, stress can have a real effect on your body, and that if you are under intense long-term stress, it probably would be a good thing to find ways to reduce that stress, to take long walks, to take a yoga class, to take meditation classes, mm-hmm. that stress reduction techniques are probably really important. On a practical level, the researchers who conducted this study believe that if it is confirmed by further research, this could be a way of sort of tracking people who are at risk for premature aging because they're under intense stress. They might be able to test their telomeres to see if they are shortening. And if they are, that's sort of a red flag that goes up that says, hey, you better do something about it and take some steps to reduce your stress.
So in the meantime, take those steps. And as you said, it's those who perceive themselves under the greatest stress who took the biggest hit here. So there's an attitude angle suggested here as well.
Sure. It does suggest that the way we perceive our environment is really important, and that you do have some control over this, and you can do things to modify your perception of the stress you're under and take steps to try to reduce that stress and to reduce the effects it has on you.
Rob, thanks very much for filling us in. I guess I should say, take it easy.
My pleasure.
Rob Stein is national science reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Washington. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court took up the issue of medical marijuana and whether states can sanction its use over the objections of the federal government. A federal appeals court judge in California ruled that marijuana use for medical purposes was different from drug trafficking. The Bush administration disagrees. Now the Supreme Court will decide, and marijuana is once again in the national spotlight. Tonight on Point, the case for and against medical marijuana and America's relationship with pot. You can join the conversation. If you were on the court, how would you rule? For or against weed for those in need? And why is marijuana in every context such a loaded issue? Why can't America resolve its marijuana issues? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Pittstown, New Jersey, is David Evans. He is executive director of the Drug-Free Schools Coalition and wrote an amicus brief supporting the Justice Department's opposition to medical marijuana before the Supreme Court. He's the author of many books on the legal aspects of substance abuse. David Evans, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
Also with us from Washington, D.C. tonight is Robert Campia, executive director of the Marijuana Policy Project, one of the organizations helping pay for the California plaintiff's case. He's testified before the California, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Ohio, and Washington state legislatures about medical marijuana. Robert Campia, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to hear a lot tonight, including hearing from Angel Raich, one of the plaintiffs in the case before the Supreme Court right now. But Robert Campia, I guess I should turn to you first. You're looking for a change in the way the nation does business. What's the case for medical marijuana use?
Yeah, point of clarity is that the case isn't looking at whether the states can sanction medical marijuana. That's not under question. The states can, and they will continue to be able to keep medical marijuana legal, regardless of what the Supreme Court rules. What the Supreme Court is looking at is whether or not the federal government has the constitutional authority to go into a state where medical marijuana is legal and to use federal resources to arrest and incarcerate sick people.
So it's a distinction with a difference, but if the feds are coming to arrest you, what the state law is doesn't seem so consequential, does it?
Well, that's what we've had already, though. Since 1996, we've passed 10 state medical marijuana laws. and the feds will go in and raid a large-scale distributor or someone growing 10,000 plants. But the feds aren't going and sweeping up and down the West Coast, arresting individual cancer patients and AIDS patients. So changing state laws actually really does provide a great deal of protection for patients.
And what's the rationale that's been put forward here for medical marijuana use? The medicine chest seems full of pharmaceuticals that are painkillers. Why marijuana as one more?
Just because some patients don't respond well to the existing medications. For instance, people who are suffering from cancer chemotherapy treatments, are vomiting, and there's a lot of good medicines on the market now to reduce the vomiting for that, but some patients just don't respond well. And, when you're vomiting from chemotherapy treatments, the last thing you want to do is to eat anything, including a pill. So taking a puff off of a marijuana cigarette provides immediate relief.
And in the states that have passed this so far, what kind of reception has there been? Do we see widespread use of medical marijuana now, or is it still largely abstract?
Well, Oregon is the best example, where medical marijuana has been legal there since 1998, passed overwhelmingly by a ballot initiative in 1998. And so far, a total of 10,000 patients across the entire state of Oregon have registered with the state government to legally possess and use and grow their own medical marijuana. So we're talking probably in states like Maine or Washington or Alaska, anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand patients per state.
David Evans, how about it then? Here we are, a nation of nearly 300 million. Robert Campia is describing a few hundred or a few thousand people with rather desperate illnesses using marijuana to ease their pain. What's the problem?
Well, there's a lot of problem with it. First of all, to characterize this as that the people that are using marijuana are all desperate people in pain. If you look at the California law, they've estimated about 100,000 people in California have found a doctor that will recommend this. Sometimes it's even done over the phone without even examining the person. And these are people that have come up with a wide variety of things that they claim marijuana helps them with. And it's very loose, unrestricted, not really medically supervised. Mr. Campia's organization supported a ballot measure in Oregon, for example, that would allow not just a physician to recommend pot, but also a naturopath and a nurse. And that it would, and the applicable medical condition would include anything that a naturopath or a nurse or a doctor thought marijuana might be good for. So it's not just being limited. They like to portray this as it being limited to these very desperately ill, sick people undergoing chemotherapy. In fact, it's been spread out to a lot of different people. The Oregon ballot initiative that they supported, which was not passed by the citizens of Oregon, would have allowed people to have up to 6 pounds of marijuana. That's several thousand joints. Now, when I was in college, anybody that had several thousand joints was considered to be a drug pusher. It also provided for giving free marijuana to people that were indigent. And even if you had not gotten an official ID card because it was recommended by a physician, it would have enabled you, if you were charged with a marijuana possession crime, to claim that you believe that it would be good medicine, and therefore you would be innocent under the law.
So the way you're describing this, David Evans, you seem to portray the whole thing as a kind of Trojan horse to get marijuana out into the hands of Americans, whether or not they're really sick.
Well, I think that, the people that make these claims, some of them are genuinely ill and may genuinely believe that this would be helpful to them. I'm not attacking it. There are some people, I think, who are faking being ill, some people are exaggerating, and some people are just outright scamming the system. But I think before we approve anything as a medicine, 100 years ago, when we had snake oil salesmen, people would make very impassioned pleas about certain types of potions and said that it would cure them and would heal them from a variety of things. Now, we found through science that a lot of times these things not only didn't help people, but they hurt people.
But this isn't snake. This isn't a mystery drug. This is marijuana, legal or not. It's fairly well known what it is and what it does.
It's fairly well known in terms of getting you high, but in terms of its medical applications, there is still a lot of research. A marijuana cigarette, and what Mr. Campia and his organization are primarily advocating is allowing people to smoke marijuana. Now, I support marijuana as medicine if it's gone through the FDA drug approval process. There are two marijuana drugs that have gone through there so far, so people do not have to break the law to get a marijuana-based drug.
David Evans, hold the thought. We're going to take a short break here. We're going to hear from Angel Raich, one of the plaintiffs in the California case before the Supreme Court when we return. You can join this conversation as well. If you were on the court, how would you rule for or against medical marijuana? And why is marijuana in every American context always such a loaded issue? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the debate over medical marijuana and America's tortured relationship with pot. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you see medical marijuana as a good mission of mercy or a gateway to wider marijuana use in society? And what about it? Is everybody talking honestly about their agendas here? Are the medical marijuana people really out to decriminalize pot? Are the opponents really just ideologues still fighting a culture war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by David Evans. He is executive director of the Drug-Free Schools Coalition, wrote an amicus brief in support of the Justice Department's attack on medical marijuana. We're joined by Robert Campia. He's executive director of the Marijuana Policy Project, which partially funded the case supporting medical marijuana that is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. And right now, we're joined from Washington by one of the principals in that case, Angel Raich. She suffers from several medical conditions, including an inoperable brain tumor. She uses marijuana to alleviate her pain. And Angel Raich, I think you were in the U.S. Supreme Court chambers watching the debate open yesterday. What did you make of the argument?
Well, you know, I thought the argument was actually very interesting. It was very clear to me that the justices were really thinking about the arguments that were before the case. It was also very clear to me that the justices, it's really difficult to really know the outcome of the decision in this case because of the fact that anytime you go to an oral argument, you know, everything is not always as it seems. Oftentimes the justices will ask the most difficult questions they could possibly ask to help them write the decision.
Their questions didn't seem all that friendly, but you're right. It doesn't always indicate how they'll ultimately decide. States' rights is a big issue here, but at the heart of this case is your circumstance and that of Diane Monson, also of California. Angel, tell us the story of how you came to be a plaintiff in this case.
Well, I was actually one of the patients that the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative was fighting for in the United States Supreme Court back in 2001. And so after the Supreme Court did not allow them to dispense medicine to the 14 medical necessity patients that were like myself, I decided to go ahead and go on the offensive and stand up for my own rights. Shortly after that, the about 3 weeks after 9/11, the federal government came into the state of California and started raiding the medical cannabis community, causing a tremendous amount of harm, sticking guns in sick people's faces, including one of the people that was my co-plaintiff, Diane Monson. And she only had six plants. And unfortunately, because I am so ill, I would never have the opportunity to put on a defense if I was ever to get raided or get arrested.
What's your medical condition, Angel, and how did you come to marijuana as an answer or palliative for it?
Well, I have multiple conditions. I have an inoperable brain tumor. I have a seizure disorder. I have life-threatening wasting syndrome. I have nine different chronic pain diseases, including fibromyalgia and degenerative joint disease, nausea, and literally the list goes on and on from there. And unfortunately, I've tried, and my doctors have recommended many, many pharmaceutical drugs, for which all have failed for me because of the fact that I'm allergic to a good portion of them. And then the rest of them, I have intolerable side effects. Unfortunately, I vomit quite violently from those medications. And it really was because of the fact that I was suffering so tremendously that a nurse pulled me aside and suggested that I talk to my doctor about using marijuana, cannabis as medicine. And I just want to say this because I think this is very important because our opponents seem to feel that we're out here just to legalize drugs. And I can tell you that prior to using medical cannabis. I was very conservative. I was very opposed to drugs, alcohol, and tobacco, and was extremely offended when the nurse suggested that I talk to my doctor. But because I do have children, and because of the fact that I love my children so much, I felt that it was in the best interest of my children to do what was right for them on their behalf. And I had to look my own ideals in the face and go out online and start researching the benefits of medical cannabis. And I found that many people were getting benefits. And, you know, cannabis is responsible for getting me out of my wheelchair. If I wasn't able to have cannabis, unfortunately, I would die rather quickly.
You're 39 years old, 100 pounds, two children. You described your medical condition for us. You smoke marijuana, I assume? That's the way you take it?
I smoke it. I vaporize it. I also make cannabis oil, for which I use a little bit of oil in my hot chocolate in the morning. I also make my own baked goods out of my grandmother's recipe for zucchini bread.
Do you need it all the time, Angel?
I need it all the time.
So you've recently taken it even this evening.
Oh, yes. I, in fact, medicated right before coming on to the show. I also might add that I use almost 9 pounds a year, and I do not get high whatsoever. I only feel the medical effects of it.
So you've taken marijuana, but you're not stoned right now, or at least you don't feel stoned.
No, I don't have any euphoric effect whatsoever.
Robert Campia, here's the case, and you're helping bring it before the Supreme Court. You know, the condition sounds awful, a number of afflictions, and medical marijuana seems to work for Angel, as she describes it. It's hard to deny somebody something when they say nothing else works. I'm in pain and wretched and would be dead without this, and yet you in this case are up against a lot of opposition from the federal government.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the people who are opposed to medical marijuana are the 20% of the American people who are, in my opinion, ideologues. 80% of the American people support medical marijuana. Every time that we've put an initiative on a statewide ballot, it's passed with regard to creating a new medical marijuana law. Where the trends are going our way, I don't know which way the Supreme Court's going to rule, but I'll tell you this. If the Supreme Court rules against us, we're no worse off than we were 2 years ago. I mean, this is a case where if we win, if Angel wins, the federal war on medical marijuana is essentially over. And if we lose, then we're back to the same old strategy of passing laws state to state until eventually Congress passes a national law.
And David Evans, when you hear Angel Rach's story, the number of afflictions that she's wrestling with, the relief that she feels she's found from marijuana, is it still your urge to deny her that marijuana, and exactly why? You think there's better alternatives or the greater good of society? How would you make the argument directly to the woman with the inoperable tumor?
Okay. Well, her story certainly sounds very compelling, doesn't it?
Yes.
I've been an attorney for 30 years, and I do personal injury work, and I've heard a lot of compelling stories. When you subject these stories, though, to objective medical analysis, cross-examination, discovery, you find out sometimes that things are not exactly the way that people say that they are.
You're saying you think Angel is toying with us? Is fooling
with us? I don't know, because as far as I know, she hasn't undergone that process. But if you read her affidavit, which you can get off her website in one of her briefs, it doesn't ring of the truth. We had a physician look it over. For example, she keeps talking about her inoperable brain tumor, okay? Sounds dreadful, doesn't it? Okay. How could you do anything against somebody that has an inoperable brain tumor?
Well, yeah, it does sound
bad. When you look at the type of brain tumor it is, it's a meningioma, which generally is a benign tumor. It's generally not cancerous. The reason that it doesn't get operated on is because generally there's no reason to operate on it.
Well, that's funny, because that's not what my doctors happen to say, and I have to jump in here because I remember you specifically from the Supreme Court back in 2001. You're the same gentleman that looked me straight in the face and told me that I should die. And I can tell you that,
Ms. Rach, that's
not
true. What happened in that interaction is that you came up to me and you said, "Why do you want me to die?" And I said, "I don't want you to die." And at the time, you told me you had cancer.
No,
and
I did not.
Excuse me, please.
You told me your
respond.
Family member had
you
cancer.
You asked me a question. Let me respond, please. and I told you that I was a cancer survivor, and I asked you questions about cancer, and it became pretty clear to me that you didn't know very much about it. 2 or 3 days later, I saw you giving a press interview where you claimed at that time that you had a neurological condition, which is why you needed the marijuana. So I guess
talking
to me, talking
to me must have cured.
You know,
I have the top. You're not. First of all, you're not a medical doctor. You are an attorney, and so you know, I really want you to know that I have the top medical physicians in the state of California, and I can tell you I've had multiple doctors. And you know, yes,
well, if you're not afraid, then would you be
benign
willing?
Tumor. However, it is a tumor that does grow in the brain nonetheless, you know. And so, you know, my tumor has been growing. It is big enough in my brain to, you know, make a spot in the brain. It is, you know, a centimeter big, which is a, you know, a fairly good sized tumor. And you know, if you knew anything about
adenomatoma,
you would
it's
have
Rachel,
to know.
Angel Rach, if I could, David Evans, if I could interject.
Yeah, please.
Angel, it must be, it's, you know, you come up against a personal injury attorney and one who's sharp and experienced and has clear views on this, like David Evans, and you're facing a lot of skepticism, and we hear it right there this evening. In general, in California, what kind of reception are you receiving? Do you get that kind of skepticism broadly, or do you find more support?
No, I, you know, in fact, you know, it's funny because David Evans is really one of the only people across the country that I've ever spoke to that has looked somebody seriously ill in the face and told them that he felt that they should die. I never
That's
said that
true.
I had
I never
cancer.
Said that
we understand he's disputing that point, and I don't want to go into a kind of cross-examination here because it's really not the forum for that, but we understand the tension that's right here.
May I ask her a question?
Attorney Evans.
Normally when somebody submits their medical condition or disabilities into a court proceeding, they allow their medical records to be examined by the other side. To test their credibility and to have a physician from the other side review the medical
So your question
record.
Is?
Would she be willing to do that?
Angel Rage?
That has never come up yet, and yes, I most certainly would, because you know what? I am not afraid. I'm very well documented, very well documented. But those have not been the facts before the case, not to mention the fact that my primary care physician that is in control of all of those records has submitted a declaration in this case for which is the facts for which I might add the federal government has never submitted any facts into this case.
Let me ask you just another question here. We don't know how the court will rule on this. Robert Campia looks more broadly and says, well, we'll get more states to sign on. But if the U.S. Supreme Court rules against you, against your case here, if you're denied the marijuana use that you currently have, how do you imagine the consequences would play out for you?
Well, you know, there's actually a couple of things that would end up having to happen. Either I have gotten lucky enough to raise my visibility enough to be, you know, not rated so that I can continue to use my medicine because I unfortunately cannot give it up because, which is in my medical records, that I would actually die without it. Otherwise, I would unfortunately have to leave the country because of the fact that, you know, I literally cannot live without it. And my doctors know that and my family knows that. And so, you know, and anybody really that knows me, that has seen me and seen how sick I really am, honestly knows that. And in fact, it's funny because the federal government's one of their attorneys has even admitted to me that he knows how ill I am because he's seen me in court. So,
well, we can see it's going to be quite a unique few months here as you wait for their court to come back with their decision. And you've already been pretty bold in putting your case out there already. Angel Rach, we're grateful to you for joining us tonight and sharing your story.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Angel Rach, one of the plaintiffs in the case before the Supreme Court right now. I want to turn now to another guest in Washington. Mark Kleiman joins us. He's professor of policy studies and director of the Drug Policy Analysis Center at UCLA. He's author of Marijuana, Costs of Abuse, Costs of Control. Mark Kleiman, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
So here we've got, in a nutshell, this debate that is now before the highest court in the land about medical marijuana use, all kinds of resonance around the edges of it. This is not like a normal conversation about a drug or a pharmaceutical. Cultural resonance, moral resonance, all kinds of things you can hear going on in this conversation.
Right. And notice that this is all remote from what the oral argument was actually about.
Which was about states' rights.
Which is all about Commerce Clause
Exactly, and which may be what decides this case. But even then, we could hear the judges asking questions to the broader issues. If we approve this, does this mean there's going to be more marijuana in the market, more marijuana on the streets? How do you interpret this debate over medical marijuana? Is this an issue of patients and a medical issue, or is it a broader cultural issue here?
Well, it clearly is a broader cultural issue. If it were resolved on its medical merits, I think, or scientific merits, I think it would have been resolved a long time ago.
In what direction?
I don't think there's any doubt that it will turn out that there are some patients for whom the mix of agents in whole cannabis outperform any other medicine or supplement whatever other medicine they're getting. That needn't be smoked cannabis. Smoking is obviously not a very good way to take a drug. But there are ways to get all of the agents in whole cannabis.
So why are we in this furious debate in that case?
Because neither side wants this resolved on scientific grounds. So the anti-marijuana side keeps saying, well, you know, if there's evidence, submit it to the FDA. But it turns out that in order to do research with cannabis in the United States on human beings, you need to get the cannabis from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And the National Institute on Drug Abuse will not make cannabis available for therapeutic studies. You can get permission to use cannabis in humans to find out how bad it is for them, but not to find out whether it's therapeutic.
And the pro-medical marijuana side?
The pro-medical marijuana side, instead of going to places where marijuana is more or less legal and where the research permission could be obtained, or suing to get access to research materials, which I think they could probably win on, much prefers to do this through litigation and referenda.
Because?
Because it's a great organizing issue. I mean, Rob Campy is entirely right. This is one of the very few drug policy issues where the, if you will, dovish side has a solid majority.
You mean they go out for referendums and time and again they win. Even in Texas, we see polls at least showing 75% for legalizing. Robert Campy, let me put that to you. Is this a kind of if medical marijuana gets the sign off, it gets approved, do you see this as a first step toward wider legalization of marijuana?
No, you know, we've always pursued our work in two tracks. I mean, we've been honest at the Marijuana Policy Project that it's our position that no responsible marijuana users who are adults should go to prison for using marijuana. But that said, we do keep medical marijuana separate because the American people are at least willing to move forward on the medical marijuana issue and to keep sick people out of jail in the short run, while, of course, we're still working in the on the broader scheme of trying to regulate marijuana like alcohol. I would
repeat
something that Mark said, which is that we actually have spent a great deal of time trying to do the research that would be necessary to move marijuana through the final hurdles to get FDA approval. You know, one thing that you need to do to get marijuana approved is to actually have your own private source of marijuana. And Mark rightly pointed out that if you want to do research now, you have to go to the government's farm. The government doesn't like to give you its marijuana, and you can't move forward. So that's why we've been working for 3 years now to try to actually start up a private production facility in Massachusetts, working in conjunction with Rick Doblin and his organization up there. And the DEA is refusing to even respond to the application to get a private production facility started so that we can use private marijuana to do privately funded studies to get it approved. So we have been working on that track, but we're being blocked, which is why we have to go the political route and win ballot initiative after ballot initiative.
All kinds of agendas here, and right at the middle of it, pot. Robert Campia, David Evans, Mark Kleiman, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the debate over medical marijuana and America's tortured relationship with pot. What do you think? What's wrong with pot for someone in pain? Why is it worse than Vicodin or OxyContin, the whole medicine chest of pharmaceutical painkillers? Or is this opening up society to drug abuse? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the debate over medical marijuana now before the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join the conversation tonight. If you were on the high court, how would you rule for or against medical marijuana use, and why can't America ever seem to resolve its marijuana issues? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a terrific panel with us tonight. Robert Campia, David Evans, Mark Kleiman. You can join the conversation as well. Chris is calling from Breivogel, North Carolina. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, that's Chris Breivogel from North Carolina, but that's close
enough. Good, great. All right. We've just named a town after you, Chris.
I just wanted to mention first that I am a PhD pharmacologist, and I've been studying the actions of marijuana in the brain for about 10 years now. And I've studied, I'm not a medical researcher, but I have studied the medical marijuana debate for some time.
So where do you come down on it, Chris?
Well, I think it definitely should be approved. The FDA, I don't think, would approve it. But I think the state should be allowed to make medical marijuana laws.
What's your argument for it? What's your argument?
Well, I would say it is the opinion of definitely the majority, probably a vast majority of scientists in the field, that there is medical potential for marijuana, beside the fact that it has very low incidence of side effects compared to most other drugs. I mean, even aspirin can kill you if you take too much of it. There's never been a known overdose case of marijuana. It just simply doesn't have the toxic potential in the body.
Chris, hang on for a moment. Let me bring David Evans in here. David Evans, I wonder if indeed it could be proven to a full scientific certainty or as near as reasonable that this was helpful, would you still be against it because of...
I think I started off by saying I'm not against the medical use of marijuana if it goes through the normal drug approval process. And I talked earlier about two marijuana-based drugs that had already gone through that process. What we're talking about here, what I'm against, is smoking of crude marijuana, of, you know, willingly recommending it for any medical condition without basing it on science. That's what I'm against.
And is your concern there that it's bad medicine or that it's bad public policy because it opens the doors? I mean, you're with the Drug-Free Schools Coalition.
I'm in favor of both. I mean, I think it's bad medicine, bad policy. Look, if you can go through the FDA process showing that smoked marijuana, and by the way, smoking a drug is a very bad way of administering anything. I'm not aware of any drug that's administered by smoking it. Smoking in itself is inherently dangerous. But what this is part of is a larger effort to get a good name on smoked marijuana. And Mr. Campia's organization, is in favor of legalizing marijuana. They see this as a red herring to be able to do that. If you ask people, if you ask me the question, am I in favor of medical marijuana? The answer is yes.
But you don't see it as properly medical.
Using anything that would help somebody, as long as we know that it's a safe, effective drug, that we can dose it properly, and we're aware of the side effects.
Chris, in North Carolina, let me ask you, you've done research on this. You hear the position of the opponent here. Does that sound like a credible base for opposition to you?
Well, he has some points. And I'd like to also, comment just that this marijuana, okay, sorry. He said he's not opposed to marijuana. What he really means, he's not opposed to marijuana-based drugs. I mean, because marijuana is a plant. It's not a drug itself. THC is the active ingredient.
If you're saying, why smoke it? Why do it in the crude form?
Well, he's got a very good point there, too. And in my opinion, I don't see that the FDA could ever approve marijuana. That's just not how the FDA works. They would have to go through and test the efficacy or safety of all of the 400-some-odd compounds in marijuana. They just don't work like that. They won't approve it, but... what has been recommended is just that patients who need it be allowed to use marijuana until some better alternative comes along.
Yeah. Chris, we've got it. Robert Campia, I want to turn to you, if I may. What about this issue of sort of raw smoked marijuana? Is there a better way? Is there a more medicalized way? Is there a reason that you're backing, just plain old marijuana smoked?
Yeah, I mean, sure, that you can eat marijuana, and there are many MS patients who do. You can vaporize it, which means you inhale the active ingredients but not smoke. A lot of patients in California are doing that now. You know, but I got to say, I'm a little frustrated hearing David talk the way he does because, you know, he talks about his concerns about smoking marijuana, but he wouldn't support our ballot initiatives if we said that marijuana were legal for medical purposes if you had to eat it. He complains about some initiatives allowing people to have too much marijuana. Mm. But if we said, how about only an ounce of marijuana, he'd probably oppose that. He complains about initiatives.
I'm opposed.
You know, the point here.
Yes, drug
if I may finish.
Yeah, one second, please. Robert Campia, please.
Yeah, the point here is that he uses all these sort of concerns as a smokescreen for his real position. His position is that he opposes changing the law to allow patients to use medical marijuana legally. What that means is that he actually thinks that patients who have their doctor's approval to use marijuana, those patients should go to prison. That's his position.
David Evans?
Well, Mr. Campy absolutely has not listened to anything that I've said this whole 45
What's your position
minutes.
On our Montana initiative?
Very clearly, I'm in favor of medicines, and I named two medicines that have gone through the process that are marijuana-based that patients can use. They do not have to break the law. There's also a drug that's going through the FDA right now, a cannabis-based drug, that you will be able to spray into someone's mouth that will provide the beneficial effects for spasticity, and it's going through the FDA process and getting approved. I think it's up to like the level 3.
Yeah, and so in the meantime,
this,
you know, patients should go to jail. That's your position.
That. I do not.
In the meantime, I think I want to get one more caller in here. Our time's running down. Alan's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'll make this brief. I really don't care about either side of this little Donnybrook, except that it's illustrative, I think, of three main currents in our current political life. I was, frankly, much more interested on the national debt program, which was excellent. Number one, fear. Number two, hypocrisy. Number three, control. Very quickly. Fear, I don't think either side of this little tete-a-tete understand one another, and of course that's ignorance, and that's the basis of fear. Hypocrisy is the big one. My God, man, have you ever gone into a drugstore? This country is awash in drugs.
Painkillers everywhere.
I rarely take an aspirin, so I find the whole thing rather amusing. Mm. Thirdly, control. Well, we do seem to live in a time when there are a lot of people that would like to go around controlling other people's behavior when it's not hurting anyone. Now you're getting the libertarian point of view.
Yep.
A lot of this, frankly, is ridiculous, and some days I wish people would just sit down and be quiet.
But Alan, we've got our time is so short, but we've got your point and appreciate it. Mark Kleiman, we've just got a minute left here. How do you see all this sorting out? Are we still in the grip of is this a kind of culture war being battled out on marijuana grounds? What's really going on at bottom here?
That seems to be what's going on. There's an outfit in Britain called GW Pharmaceuticals, which has figured out a way to extract all of the chemicals in whole cannabis and make a standardized medicine out of that that would be taken by either vaporization or by making aerosolization.
But not smoking.
Not smoking. There's no particular reason to smoke it if you can vaporize the stuff with heat. I noticed Mr. Evans's brief is quite sarcastic about that prospect, but doesn't give any reason to think that that's the wrong move. There's no evidence that the cannabis-based medicines that have been approved to date are either as effective or have as little side effect as whole cannabis.
And we just got half a minute here. Where do you think the country's headed on this? Are we always going to have a big divide over marijuana, or do you see the states one by one, as Robert Campy clearly hopes, coming around, voting this in, and the feds eventually saying okay?
The feds will not eventually say okay until the voters change. Lots of voters who would vote for a medical marijuana initiative would vote against the congressman who voted, as his opponent would no doubt say, to legalize marijuana. So I think it's going to take a big change in public opinion for even medical marijuana to make it through the Congress. I think the more likely way to resolve it is that GW Pharmaceuticals will get its approval in Britain and then eventually apply for FDA approval.
Make
here.
It a pill that you can sell in a drugstore, and maybe it will happen. Mark Kleiman, professor of policy studies and director of the Drug Policy Analysis Center at UCLA, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And David Evans, executive director of the Drug Free Schools Coalition, grateful to you for being with us.
You're welcome.
And finally, Robert Campy, executive director of the Marijuana Policy Project, which funded the case supporting medical marijuana before the Supreme Court right now. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
In a moment, another shakeup in the Bush cabinet. This is On Point. Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge announced today he will be stepping down in February unless his successor is approved before then. Ridge is the first man to hold the post, which was created in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks. He was given the unenviable task of creating a new bureaucracy out of 180,000 people from disparate agencies. While some critics argue the department sometimes moved slowly and failed to meet some of its goals, Ridge said today he's pleased with the progress that has been made in the past 2 years.
I think we've accomplished a great deal in a short period of time. As I said to the president, there will always be more work for us to do in Homeland Security. But if you take a look at many of the innovations, the improvements to security, the enhancements to safety at ports of entry, the partnerships that we've developed with the state and locals and the private sector. Just all in all, I think it's a reflection of the commitment and the dedication and the energy and the professionalism, really the combined power of about 180,000 people strong. I know I've said to many of my coworkers, not only in Washington but around the country during my tenure as their secretary, that on a day-to-day basis, one could say that individual decisions that these men and women make out there at ports of entry have as much to do with the security of the country as any individual decisions we might make here at headquarters. As I said to you many times before, we have to be right a billion-plus times a year, meaning we have to make literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of decisions every year or every day, and the terrorists only have to be right once.
Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge announcing his resignation earlier today. He becomes the seventh cabinet member to resign since the election. Joining me now to discuss Tom Ridge's legacy and the future of his department is Siobhan Gorman. She covers Homeland Security for the National Journal. Siobhan Gorman, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So what do you know? Why did Tom Ridge decide to step down?
Well, I think that perhaps certainly one reason would be that he can step down with his resume intact. He presided over our first sort of Homeland Security operation without an attack, and that's probably a pretty good time to leave.
So breathe a sigh of relief and get out of town.
I think so. Well, maybe not get out of town. Maybe go into the private sector in Washington, D.C., but, you know, say, okay, we've been there and we've done that, and I've done my service, but it's time to go.
Is there any indication of how the White House has looked upon Tom Ridge, whether they wanted him to stay or they were happy for him to go?
I think that there may well be some ambivalence. I have sensed some ambivalence in general from the White House vis-a-vis Homeland Security. I mean, it's certainly something that the president supported when they started the department, but at the same time, the president went to war when the department was standing up, and so it hasn't really been his focus the whole way through. And while I'm sure that the president is generally happy with Ridge's performance, I'm not sure that there's sort of a strong sentiment one way or the other. There was a longstanding assumption that Secretary Ridge would probably step down, somewhat shortly after the election.
And what about the general sense in Washington of what kind of job Tom Ridge has done, pulling together a very big bureaucracy? There has not been an attack or a major attack, but that's not the only indicator. People must be looking more closely at the kind of organization he's built. What's the report card he gets going away?
Well, if you look at the organization itself, you have to start out with the caveat that it's obviously a very difficult job, and he certainly inspired a lot of loyalty among the people working for him, and that was a top priority of his going in. At the same time, internally at the department, there is quite a lot of bureaucratic warfare, and if you look at how the department has sort of staked out its responsibilities and territories within the federal government, it's lost an awful lot of bureaucratic battles to the FBI or to the CIA. One of the big new purposes of the department was to have a place where all the information and intelligence could come together and be analyzed vis-a-vis terrorism,
mm-hmm.
and that's been taken away from the department, basically.
So this may not or has not emerged as the real cutting edge of America's anti-terrorism efforts.
It's not become the cutting edge of America's anti-terrorism efforts at all. I think that has been reserved for the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, which has had a bit of a rocky start, too, but has received, I think, some significant support from the White House. And there, you know, some other sort of significant terrorist hunting responsibilities have really gone to the FBI. I think that the president has developed a very strong relationship with Director Mueller at the FBI as well.
And Siobhan, just in the 20 seconds we've got here, names being tossed around as replacements for Tom Ridge, successors?
Asa Hutchinson, who is a deputy of Ridge's, was tossed around early on, but now it seems like the front runners are perhaps Fran Townsend, who is the Homeland Security Advisor to the President, as well as Michael Levitt, who is currently the EPA Administrator, but was the former governor of Utah and presided over the Salt Lake City Olympics, which was a big security effort.
Siobhan Gorman, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
Siobhan Gorman, she covers Homeland Security for the National Journal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.